everybody, what's up? This is Harry from the Next Issue Podcast, and we're out and about in Baltimore today, and we have with us a special guest by the name of Ethan Van Sciver. What's going on, man?
Just sitting here in beautiful downtown Baltimore. This isn't downtown Baltimore, is it?
We're actually uptown.
Uptown Baltimore.
Probably about 10 minutes from downtown. 10-15.
At Collector's Corner. I'm doing a signing today. And actually, more of a sketching. I just started my first sketch of the day. Let me do Batman.
Let me ask you this. Just kind of jump into it. When you're looking at DC's New 52, what's the general feeling with everyone about how it's going and things like that? So what is your take on it?
Well, when it first started happening, it was very secretive and compartmentalized, and nobody quite understood the extent of the overhaul that DC was planning. And it was very secretive. Again, I didn't know what my friends were doing. They didn't know what I was doing. We were all told to hush. But when it rolled out, it was a tremendous success, and I think it was the kind of infusion of energy that DC Comics really, really needed at that moment. And you know, even now, I think the books are doing really well. We try to keep it interesting, and I feel like creatively, everybody is challenged all the time to try new things and different things. And outdo the next guy. So it's good. It's a really good feeling.
Cool. And what is your favorite character that you like working on?
Oh, it's hard to say. I'm having fun drawing Batman right now. But the thing about working on superheroes and being a fan of superheroes is that you're always looking over your shoulder, over your friend's shoulder, at what they're doing, and you get envious. I'd love to draw Shazam. I'd love to draw more Flash. I'd love to draw more Green Lantern. I'd love to draw Wonder Woman. So it's good to kind of to keep things loose and open and just be willing to roll with opportunity as it comes along. There is no DC book that I don't want to do.
Yeah, I would like to see another Shazam book. I just read the last Justice League issue with the finishing of Shazam's mini story, and I'm really hoping to see more of that because I thought it was interesting. I thought the art was great.
Oh, yeah.
And had a really great direction to it. And I think that was one of the things that a lot of people were scared of when the New 52 started up. It was like, oh, my God, they're rebooting. How can they butcher characters and things of that sort? But I don't think they really butchered a lot of characters. I think, especially for me, since I was just getting back into a lot of DC books, DC did a really good job of easing people back in.
Well, they timed it just right. It's funny that you should say that. I forgot about this until just now, but you know, when the 52 was planned, which was, I think, September of 2011,
right?
It followed
September of 2011. That's fairly recent.
Yeah. I think this is the third year of. I can't remember now at all. But anyway, but the whole thing was, look, we were following up on a summer of huge blockbuster movies,
right?
That had really excited just the general public about superheroes, and I think that in the past we had seen big, huge blockbuster superhero movies like Spider-Man and the X-Men and Batman Begins hit the public like a bomb. They wanted more, but for some reason we weren't seeing them flocking to comics.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the biggest things that you don't see a lot of. You get a superhero movie out, but there's no promotion saying, hey, look, if you want to find out more about this character, go to the nearest comic shop. And really, I think that's where the biggest disconnect is that we don't, well, put this way, movie theaters and movie owners don't have a way to really promote those. Like, you would think if there was a movie coming out, okay, Iron Man 3 is coming out, we should get some comic books and give some of those comic books away. We should have, like, theater promos or something like that and get it in people's hands. So that way, especially with the children, when the children come out, Mom, I want an Iron Man comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Get them to the shops. That way you can turn that business over from the movies to the shops. And that's what's missing.
Yeah, and I think the other thing was that, you know, once you get people into the stores and say they really like the Batman movie and they want Batman comics, and they go in there and they see Detective Comics number 859.
Right.
And they're just like, this is hopeless. You know, I can't, why would I pick up, I can't pick up the other 858 issues. I can't afford it.
Right.
So it seemed like, you know, just the weight of continuity was scaring new readers off. Right at a point when new readers were being invited into the industry by these great movies. So DC timed the New 52 to say, okay, the summer blockbuster movie season is over. You just saw Avengers. You just saw Dark Knight Rises. And God knows whatever else came out. Spider-Man. Here we go. Here are the comic books, starting with the new line of number ones. No continuity for you to sort of be confused by. You know, it's a brand new day, and people really responded to it.
Yeah, because the one big day that you would think all this would happen is, of course, Free Comic Book Day. What happens on Free Comic Book Day? There's a big movie that's being released. You guys got questions? Feel free to jump in. Anybody? Don't be shy.
Did you see Superman?
Yes. Yeah, I did. Well, I came out of it with mixed feelings. I felt like it was...
And it's okay to spoil it, by the way. If you haven't seen it by now, I feel sorry for you.
Yeah,
people
should have seen it by now. While I was watching it, I was really involved, and I was excited by the sophisticated, kind of moody take on Superman, which is something that I hadn't seen before in the movies. I'd started to see it in the comics. But I was enjoying myself, but as the movie was going on, I became increasingly stressed out by the fact that Superman wasn't protecting anyone.
He had a big body count.
Talking about Man of Steel.
Yeah.
Like, I only care about four people.
Yeah.
And one jumped into a tornado.
Willingly.
That was odd. That struck me as really odd, too. But mostly, I just watched Superman just sort of... It started for me in the scene... this really worked for me, when Zod was threatening Superman's mother.
Right.
And Superman just came and hit him. Like, I mean, you got to see Superman's powers work the way they really look. You'd never seen that before.
Yeah.
I mean, not even in the cartoon. You know, we've never seen what Superman's powers actually would look like. This showed it for the first time. He's punching Zod. He's saying... get away from my mother or something like that, and that was terrific. And then for some reason they came into town and blew up the gas station, and here's the gas station's on fire, people are running out, and I thought, well, he's going to use his super breath and blow it out.
No,
you know,
he just kept right on fighting.
That was the first time when I was like, okay, well, he's got to turn around now and blow out that fire. He's got to, that's what Superman would do. And he let it burn. And that, like, stayed in the back of my mind, and it really bothered me throughout the whole fight. And then it just got worse and worse and worse and worse. And I was like, Superman isn't going to do a damn thing.
But
you know?
Every time he tried to, that's when Peora or the other dude would come and fight him and take him someplace.
It doesn't matter. See, you have to understand, though. These are artificially constructed stories.
Right.
Somebody wrote this,
right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like... They
could have signed off on them writing too.
Right. You could have written it in such a way that Superman was under... That was a big plot point. Great pressure to make sure that Smallville doesn't burn to the ground and that every single citizen is safe, you know, and survives. And that way, if we had to get to that moment at the end, you know, where the neck breaks, it would have been like, look, he saved everyone's life. He couldn't save this guy's life. And it would have been okay, because it's like he was asking for it. But why is Superman mourning Zod when God knows what the... thousands of people died? It was... The more I thought about it, the more upsetting it was. You know, I came out of the theater going, I think I liked it. I'm not sure if I liked it. I have to think about it more. It was miles better than... that other Superman movie.
Yeah, Superman Returns. Yeah, I think what happened with Superman Returns, they wanted to play safe and try to give a homage to the Christopher Reeves version, so they didn't want to take any chances. And
you're exactly
this go
right.
Around, they said, well, let's just throw it all to the wind and see what happens. It's either going to stick or it's not. And I think to a point, like it or hate it, Man of Steel has kind of like gotten DC back on track because, you know, the crazy part is looking at how Marvel has things set up for their next set of movies. They're light years ahead, whereas DC is still floundering. But what I've noticed, too, is with the animation department, it's kind of a reverse with that, whereas mm-hmm. DC has some really kick-ass anime out there.
Yeah.
Isn't it ironic that Marvel can make a great movie, but they can't make a good cartoon? DC makes great anime, but they can't make a good movie.
I've always said that. That's just been weird for me.
Well, it's just a matter of understanding our characters, because I don't feel like Hollywood does. And Superman, that first Superman movie, the first two Superman movies were perfect.
The Donner ones.
That was who Superman is. He's a good. He's a good farm boy. He's got the sense of morals, a sense of responsibility. He's an American. I honestly don't think Hollywood understands that anymore. With Superman Returns, the idea that Superman would have a child out of wedlock with Lois Lane is outrageous. It's outrageous.
And then that claim it.
And then right. And then the idea that Superman, yeah, that he would leave the planet Earth to go find Krypton, a planet he's never been to since he was a day old. He has no attachment to it whatsoever. He knows it's gone. Why did he leave Earth for 5 years while his child grew up fatherless? While God knows what crime and horrors went on in his absence, it was just, like, I get goosebumps as I talk about it. I'm so angry about it. It's like, and then this, the idea that Superman wouldn't protect people, that wasn't his primary responsibility, is to just protect us from this. You know, not get revenge. And somebody said a really scary thing to me about this movie that I just thought really hit home. They said, so, after Man of Steel, you realize that the worst thing that ever happened to planet Earth is that Superman came to it. And I went, Jesus, that's exactly right. What good did Superman do for us at the end of Man of Steel? Nothing. Like, Zod came because Superman came to it, and Superman didn't do anything to protect us, essentially. He just beat the crap out of Zod, who was only there to capture him. So,
because he activated the signal that brought him there.
Exactly. And
pretty
then
much.
These wonderful human beings gave their lives, essentially. They crashed that thing into the thing or whatever it was. And human beings saved themselves and from Superman's mayhem. That's what happened in that movie.
I don't read it that way. I didn't come out of the movie. I mean, I had my doubts the first time I went in. The second time I went, put my kid.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my daughter teared up a couple of times during the movie. Like, stuff between Pa Kent. Things between Jor-El and a lot of that, I felt like they got so right that for me, stuff. Anything that fell short, it kind of made up for it.
Well,
I get what you're saying, I mean, believe me, but I felt like I attributed it to he's discovering all of his powers, and because there are so many different people, he's having.
Oh my God!
What up?
What's going on, fellas? Come on in.
LIDIN, brother.
Oh my God! All right, we're holding court here. We're discussing Man of Steel.
Dude. How are you, my friend?
Great to see you.
Great to see you.
Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great to see you.
It's nice
Thanks
to see you.
Coming out.
Can we have more chairs?
Yeah.
Are there
more? We can get more.
Okay. We need my friends here.
But you know, now the biggest comparison, of course, is
interview.
Yeah. And feel free to jump in. We're just kicking it around. Of course, now the big comparison a lot of people have made, well, what about the Avengers? What about the body count of Avengers? They didn't save anybody. At the end of the Avengers, half of New York's been destroyed, but now they're sitting around eating falafel.
The majority of that off screen.
Yeah.
And then, Mark, but see, that's what bothers me about a lot of the movies is that they try to be realistic in a sense to ground them to make them more viewable to more acceptable to the general public.
Right.
Which, as a comic fan, sometimes that gets in your crawl. But But you have to have, you know, if you're going to have people fighting that have power levels like that, there's going to be
damage. There's going to be damage,
yeah. There's going to be damage. There's going to be, you know. And even if you look at some of the older comics, they hinted at a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like even in the 70s, there was more of it.
See, here's the difference between the Avengers and Man of Steel, is that Loki, why did Loki come to Earth? Loki came to Earth to enslave it. You know, if the Avengers hadn't been there, the Avengers had nothing to do with Loki aside from Thor, who knew him as his brother. If the Avengers hadn't have been there, we would have been screwed. We would have been slaves to, you know, Loki's demons or whatever they were. But the Avengers were there and they saved Earth. Superman did not save anything. I mean, Man of Steel, he didn't save anyone or anything. You know, it's like, if Superman never came to Earth, we would have been great.
No, I thought about that.
And I mean, I didn't smile or laugh or feel good once during Man of Steel. I laughed all through Avengers, and just, there are all these moments where you just were like, you know? That felt good to see that.
Avengers was very formulaic, like three-act. You know, origin story, talking in the middle, big climactic battle. I didn't feel like Man of Steel stayed to that formula.
Right,
It kind of meandered in good ways, I thought.
And quite honestly, maybe to help the local economy, because they had Schwarm at the end. So, it did spend money, so.
I will not go out of my way to defend Marvel Comics here.
On that point.
Anybody, any more questions? Any other things you want to kick in?
This is your interview.
I know this. But since I got a crowd of people sitting around, I know there's things that people want. Okay, you know what, fine. What's next up for you? What else are you working on this year?
You know what? I think I'm doing more Dark Knight Returns, but right at this very moment, Dark Knight Returns. No, Batman the Dark Knight.
Yeah, I was like, okay.
But at this moment, as I sit here, I'm not sure, and I won't really know until next week, because you know, this other job kind of popped up at DC, this other gig, and I want it, and so I'm asking for it this week.
Can you tell us what it is, or nah, secret thing?
Yeah, it's secret right now, but so I don't know if they say yeah, and you know, we'll start next week, then I won't do any more Batman for a while, but.
See if they can get you on a Shazam or a Flash gig. That's
well, both of those books are well in hand, aren't they? I mean, Shazam, forget it. As long as Gary wants that book, he's got it. And Flash is doing real well with Francis. I would like Wonder Woman. I haven't read it. I don't know if it's any good. But I love that character. I'd like to get around to drawing some Wonder Woman stuff.
Okay. And I guess my last question would be, since we just had a young lady here earlier inquiring, when you talk to aspiring artists or people that want to break into the biz, what is some of the advice that you give them? What do you like to tell them?
Well, I mean, the thing is about breaking into comics is that it's really not as hard as it seems. People who break into comics and who do this for a living are people who draw comics anyway, who have been drawing comics since they were 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, will eventually do this no matter what. I mean, it's just their destiny. I think the idea that at some point, you know, in your mid-30s, you decide that you're going to become a comic book artist, I think that's, you know, that's just not the way it works. It's an instinctive thing that just kind of is a huge part of your life. You give your life over to it, and eventually, you know, I see it as kind of a stepladder. You start out drawing comics in school for your friends, and then you're drawing them for a small press company, and then you're being paid, and then, you know, eventually you find yourself at Marvel or DC, if that's what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how to break in? Do your own comic book. Do your own comic
book. That's
what
I'm trying to push my wife to do. She's a graphic artist. She's working now for the FDA, and she does great stuff. I'm like, why don't you just do something? But, you know, I guess it's a motivation factor also. You just have
That's
to have
the
an
big
idea.
Thing. Yeah, I mean, the people who want to draw comics don't need to be motivated to do it. They are motivated to do it. They just do it.
Yeah. Yeah, because I go to a lot of the shows, and when you go to Artist Alley, and, you know, just a quick plug, Baltimore Comic Con is coming up in September, everybody. Please make sure you go. You know, go check out the Artist Alley, because you see a lot of indie people around, and everybody goes around looking at everybody else, but there's a lot of these indie writers out here you need to look at today, because you never know who might be that big star tomorrow.
Okay. Well, that's exactly right. You know, when I started, I was doing a book called Cyberfrog, and we used to do the Elkhart, Indiana County Fair, and we'd have a table set up between the stalls of cows and horses. Yeah. Literally, we'd be trying to sell our comics, and there were horses over here, cows over here, elephant ears outside, and everyone who worked with me at Hall of Heroes has gone on to do something else, either in comics or in entertainment somehow. So you got to start somewhere, and the rising stars are in Artist Alley. Also, some people who are nuts and shouldn't be there. You'll figure it out.
Who inspires you when you draw? Who's some of the guys that you really look up to?
I don't even know anymore. I know everybody now. That's the thing. It used to be easy because they seem so distant and they seem like celebrities to me. I would look up to John Byrne and Todd McFarlane and Dale Keown, but now these guys are people that I know personally, and some of them have turned out to be horrible human beings. So there isn't really anyone who inspires me anymore. I inspire me. My family inspires me. My friends inspire me. Staying up late at night and having crazy dreams that I wake up and remember and lead to some other idea. That's the kind of thing that inspires me now.
All right. And we're going to end that. Now, can we get a round of applause?
Thank you.
Thank you for coming up, man. I'm glad you came, and hopefully we'll see you at another Baltimore show pretty soon. Right? Yeah, yeah.
Don't well, if I'm invited, yeah. I have never been invited to Baltimore Comic Con, ever.
Okay, yeah, we make sure we get into some recording, because we want to see you come up. And I have to say, even for myself, one of the things I've always liked about the Baltimore show is it's still about comics. It hasn't gotten so mainstream where it's about everything else, but hopefully that time will never happen. But we'll see what we can do. So thank you.
Thank you, Harry.
HC.
Okay, folks, and we are here with Randy Myers at Collective Corner near Parkville. And you guys have really, really expanded since the last time I've been here. Let the folks know what you've done.
We took over the building next to us and revealed it to the public in May on Free Comic Book Day this year, adding about 4,000 square foot to what we already had, bringing us up around 8,500 to 9,000 square feet.
Wow.
So pretty big, and mainly that area is being used for bargain merchandise, anything from a dollar comics to $5 trade paperbacks and used trade paperbacks, to half-off manga, and then also all of our apparel is in that area now, and all of our gaming merchandise is all in that area, so it really opened up the shop a lot.
I saw that. And where did you move the gaming area? Because I know where we're standing now, you used to have it here. Where is it now?
Yeah, it's actually in the basement of the adjacent building.
Wow.
Yeah, so all that is connected now, and everybody does gaming down in that basement, so the entire top floor of both buildings now is all retail.
Cool. Yep. Now, also, just what was it, last month or the month before last, you all did a collector's con.
Mm-hmm.
How did that go? Because it looked like it was going really, really nice when I was there.
Yeah, for our first time doing a convention, just trying to bring a smaller, more eclectic show that covered more collectibles and toys and different types of merchandise, it went very well. I think we were a little under 400 people through the door.
Right, yeah. Right. And any more plans on doing it again this year?
Yeah,
or?
We are going to do another one in November. I haven't given out the date yet, but we're going to try to make sure that there are no other conventions on that weekend, at least not in the immediate area or in the next 3 or 4 states, if we can try to do that.
Right.
Because there are so many conventions right now I mean, there are multiple anime conventions and multiple comic book conventions and toy shows, and it's really hard to find a time when there's not already anything going on.
Right. So that is the main focus of Collector's Con, though, is to focus a little bit more on collectibles and that sort
of
stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's comic book centric because that's the nature of what is really in vogue right now, kind of. You know, more people are getting into comic books, I think, now, and toys along with that. And but we wanted to have a little bit more of a range of stuff. So you have gaming, which we actually had some game like games and stuff, and Glenn Burney, he came out and set up Canton Games from downtown in Baltimore. They came out, and then a lot of local comic book stores like Chuck's Comics. Of course, we had our own table. You know, we tried to invite everyone from the area to make it more of a localized, very small to mid-size, you know.
Right. And that's the other thing I noticed, like, just last weekend I was over in Annapolis Con, and it looks like sort of like the same players. So it's really good to see everybody's working together to make sure that, you know, this is like the main thrust. Like, these are the stores that you have in the area, you know.
Yeah.
So it looks like it helps everyone.
Yeah, I feel
out.
Like when everybody kind of works together, we all benefit from that.
Right.
You know.
Right. Any plans for Baltimore Comic Con in September?
Yeah, we're gonna be set up there. We've been there every year, I think, except for maybe two. I don't recall what years, but I mean, I've done it, I guess, since 1998 or 99, all the way till now. I mean, we'll always do Baltimore Comic Con.
Okay.
It's a great show.
Cool. And last question: what are some of the upcoming events that you got between this month and next month?
Well, right now we have Ethan Van Sciver, you know, is signing as we speak, and I think we have another creator that we're kind of holding back, but we're going to announce probably later summer, end of summer, fall.
Okay.
We have Baltimore Comic Con, we have Halloween Comic Fest coming up, which was really big here last year, so we have people dressing up, giving out free comics, giving out candy, costume contest, all kinds of things going on. That'll be on Halloween night.
Mm-hmm.
And we got some other things coming up that we're not really talking about right now. Really cool things that we're going to do in the shop. Yeah.
All right. And as always, tell people where they can find you on the internet.
We're at www.collectorscornermd.com.
All right. And they got a Facebook page. Make sure you join the Facebook page.
Twitter, all that
stuff. And if you know how to find Randy too. And I'm not going to tell you. All right. Thank you very much, man.
Take care, man.
Okay.
Yep. Thanks, Eric.
You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, break on through to the other side, yeah.
Hi, this is Greg, and I'm at Heroes Con, as you can hopefully hear, and I'm here with Charles Soule. Charles, how's the show been going for you?
It's been a blast. You know, I this is probably my fourth time at Heroes Con. It's always one of the best cons of the year. It's full of great artists and writers, and it's always really fun.
Good. Now, you're here promoting a couple of different works, covering a couple of different things. One book that that just came out, I think, within the last month or so.
That's right.
Is called Strange Attractors. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Strange Attractors is a beautiful hardcover graphic novel that was put out through Archaea, who does a lot of beautiful hardcover graphic novels. Yeah, it's kind of their thing. And my particular one is a book about New York City, which is where I've lived for 16 years. The story. Basically, it covers two mathematicians. So I hopefully haven't lost you yet. But so there's two genius mathematicians who sort of use complexity theory and the butterfly effect to use all of New York City's systems almost as an engine or a big machine that they can then, you know, use to do different things. And in the story, there's this big crisis that's coming down. It's going to destroy the whole city, and they have to try and, you know, keep it alive. It's a very cool story.
Yeah, it is a very cool story, which I read last night, so I can say that.
Very fresh.
Truthfully.
Okay.
Do you have a math background? Do you have any sort of scientific math background at all?
You know, I'm a layman as far as that stuff goes. I mean, I've always really enjoyed it. So I did a lot of research and homework before I wrote this book because I wanted to make sure that. When I was talking about these incredibly high-level mathematical concepts, I didn't get them too wrong. I'm sure I got them somewhat wrong, but not too wrong. But I think in a way that almost helped me because it meant that I had already gone through the process of explaining this stuff to myself, which meant that I could then hopefully explain it to readers in a way that was accessible as well, you know?
Okay. Did you, for the concept, did you come at it more from maybe from like a like an interest in the math and then an application of that math to the situation, or like a situation and sort of break it down and be like, okay, because in some ways they're, I don't want to say superheroes saving a city, but in some ways they're sort of like superheroes saving a city, and yet it's completely not a superhero book.
No.
So how did you sort of approach that, with the paradigm of...
It started with the city, for one thing. I mean, I've lived in New York City for a decade and a half, 16 years, and I love New York. I've lived in a lot of different places, and New York is just the be-all and end-all for me. So it started with the idea of writing a book that would do justice to the complexity of New York, and the way it is all layered and it all kind of works together somehow like a big machine or whatever you want to say. And then it became about finding a mechanism to tell a story that would reflect that complexity, and in an organic way that was still cool and fun and interesting to read. And so that's kind of where the whole idea of you know, making these guys mathematicians who could understand all that complexity. Because when you're living in the city, like, you know there's a lot going on, but there's no way you can get your head around all of it. And I thought the idea of two guys who were just that good, just that sharp, to be able to sort of hold the whole city in their head all at once was a pretty cool idea. And hopefully it's executed well in the book.
It is. Now, speaking of execution, let's talk about your artist. Who drew the book?
The penciler and inker is a guy named Greg Scott, who's based in Staten Island, New York. It was very important to me to get an artist who really knew New York City well, because the locations in the book are so crucial, and you know, you need to really pay that off so that, you know, when people are reading a book that's so steeped in New York and it's sort of mythology and locations, you want to make sure that they feel like they're actually in those locations when they're reading the various scenes. So Greg Scott drew it. The colors are by Art Lyon and Matthew Petz. Matthew's also a New Yorker. He lives in Brooklyn. And then there's also an element of the story where
the maps,
the complexity maps. The two mathematicians sort of diagram out all the city's systems, and that helps them do the work that they do. And I hired a Brooklyn-based fine artist named Robert Sawitz to create those maps, and he knocked that out of the park. You know, they're just beautiful, kind of intricate works that you know, exceeded my expectations 100%.
So. I will say, there's a lot of math in this book. However, there aren't a lot of numbers. So it's math in the same way that Jurassic Park has chaos theory math, and yet there's no real numbers in Jurassic Park. So just for, you know, we use mathematics or math in sort of describing this book. It is very accessible. The use of both the maps and, in some ways, when these two mathematicians are looking and sort of doing calculations in their head of certain events and probabilities of things happening, I think you guys do a really good job of sort of showing that visually. So it's something that could have been, I'm sure, is very technical when you, in some aspects, but it's prevented very visually and attractively in Strange Attractors.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I felt like, going back to a point I made earlier, is that making the book accessible. I didn't want to put in a bunch of formula and things like that. I mean, every once in a while they'll show up in the background.
Yeah, just enough.
But they generally speaking, you know, in my reading about sort of mathematicians and math and the way they think, they're working on a very abstract level of thought that, I mean, numbers is only... they're just one part of the way they think about things.
Right.
There's a lot of... it's more, you know, all these cogs and ratchets and gears, and they're all different parts of math, and you know, math is not arithmetic. It's a very different thing. So, anyway, I hope it... I'm glad to hear that you felt that way, because it was something I was very conscious of, trying to make it not off-putting and not inaccessible.
Oh, no. There's math involved, but it is very easy to read, very accessible,
and a good
story.
Yeah, it's a thriller, really. I mean, it's an exciting, you know, almost a sci-fi thriller in a lot of ways. Like a very real-world, you know...
Now, did you take this to Arkea, or did Arkea sort of put you... did you take it to Arkea and they put you together with Greg?
No.
Did you sort of package it and then...
Yeah, I packaged it. Arkea is primarily a creator-owned shop, so they do some of their own licensed books, but by and large, you go to them with a project, a pitch. And the original artist I actually had on the book was a guy named Dan Duncan, who did the cover. He only ended up being able to do the cover, which is, you know, a shame, but then Greg stepped in and really, really knocked it out of the park. So, you know, things tend to happen for a reason in comics projects, so... but Arkea has been very, very supportive of this project from the very beginning to the end, to getting it to, you know, you can't see it because this is a podcast or an interview, but the book itself is this beautiful object with you know, it's all like embossed on the cover and it's
reasonably
got this gatefold
reasonably priced. It's a $20 hardcover.
Yeah, which is great. I don't know how they make any money, you know, pricing these things how they do, but it's I'm really, really proud of the look and I hope people find it.
Yeah. It's not my problem, I'm just gonna buy it, you know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Well, you also let's see. You also do some work for DC, I hear.
Yes. I'm doing a little bit of work for DC right now.
When you're not telling us about, you know, I guess people saving one metropolitan city, you are.
Yep.
I guess you don't actually cover anybody that saves any other metropolitan city, but still, at least not at the moment.
That's sort of a transition.
What you can't see here is that you have a banner-ish something of a ad for reading Swamp Thing, which you are currently writing after Scott Snyder. How did you get that?
Well, basically, last fall at New York Comic Con, I was approached by DC, one of the editors of DC, who said, you know, would you be interested in pitching for something? And I didn't know what it was, but I said, sure, I would love to pitch for something. And then a week or two later, I was told that the thing that I was pitching for was Swamp Thing, which so I, you know, I had a real, like, you know, oh my God moment. Like, that's, writing Swamp Thing is an amazing gig, because, I mean, you look at the list of some of the people who've written that book over the decades, and it's some of the best writers in comics. I mean, Alan Moore, obviously, but also Brian K. Vaughan, and Grant Morrison, and Mark Miller, and Joshua Dysart, and just, like, one amazing name after another. So it was intimidating a little bit, but I just like anything else, you figure out a take, you do your best, you put your ideas out there, and hopefully they like them. And in this case, they did, and so I got the job and started working right away. And my first issue came out in April, which was 19. Since then, 20 and 21 have come out, and the response has been really gratifying and great. People seem to really enjoy it, which has been phenomenal.
So when I say the word, or I guess the phrase, Swamp Thing, what's the first thing that comes into your head?
Work right now. It's work, a job. I mean, okay. Because I'm doing it. But before I was writing it, I would have said something like, ideas and depth. I mean, the thing about Swamp Thing, as opposed to maybe some of the other characters, who are also great, they're just different things, mm-hmm. is that Swamp Thing has been used as a character where you can tell stories about philosophy, about, you know, they can be action, they can be sort of superhero stuff, but they can also be, you know, weird War of the Plants stuff, and like it's a book where almost anything can work if the stories are told right, and the audience that reads Swamp Thing has been more or less primed to be receptive to the idea that this is a title where it can go anywhere. So it's really fun to write, because I don't feel like there are any restrictions on the kinds of stories I can tell.
So you feel like you have a license to sort of maybe go a little further out there then, because I mean now it's no longer a Vertigo book, it's now sort of mainstream.
It is, but I think the tone, you know, even when Scott was writing it, when I'm writing it, it certainly has been a book where some darker things have been allowed. I mean, it's absolutely sort of PG-13, at if not even more sometimes, and they seem to really be behind that idea. Certainly, the readers are you know, enjoying it. The numbers are healthy, which is great to hear these days.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm having a blast. The next arc. One of the things that I've been doing on it is telling sort of short, self-contained stories, because I think that it's giving readers a new entry point all the time. So if you haven't been reading it, you can come in and pick up an issue and check it out and see if you like it. Whereas, you know, if you're working on a take that's the same thing for 2 years, 24 issues or whatever, if you lose someone in issue 3, they're not going to read it again for, you know, 21 issues. So I'm trying to do, like, mix it up a lot, do different things, but yet still have an overarching kind of feel or theme, which is fun. So,
okay. What's it like working with, is it Kano? Kano?
Kano.
Kano.
He is amazing.
I don't know how to pronounce that.
Yeah, Kano. He is really, really, really good. He does this very intricate, detailed work, and he, a lot of times, not always, sometimes he inks over himself, sometimes he doesn't, depending on his time, but it's, you know, Swamp Thing is a book that almost demands intricate detail, because, you know, you're dealing with plants and vegetation and all that, and, I mean, it would drive me nuts to do what these guys do, but it's, I mean, the work has been, I cannot say a bad word about the art on this book.
Do you work full script, or?
Full script. Full script. And then the colors, too, are by Matt Wilson, who is, you know, just a dream. So it's been really good. I can't say a single bad thing about it. I hope people check it out. It's been really fun.
Good. Yeah, I mean, I'm a little behind on it, but I did read the your first issue.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's great. You got more to come?
Yes. Yes, I bought them. I'm trying to remember. They're in my stack. I haven't gotten to them yet, but okay. I did read the first.
Cool.
I did read the first issue. That's not the only DC book you're doing, though.
No, that's true. I'm writing. Also writing Red Lanterns for DC,
okay.
Which starts later this month on June 26th. The first issue comes out for me. That'll be number 21.
Okay.
Which I'm part of the new kind of. There's a whole line-wide relaunch of the titles, so to speak. Not exactly a reboot, but certainly all of the creators have changed over. It's Rob Venditti on Green Lantern, and then Ben Jensen on Green Lantern Corps, and Justin Jordan on Green Lantern New Guardians, and I'm on Red Lanterns. So. And they are a bunch of really, really talented writers, and it's been really fun to kind of start building a new set of stories out of the Green Lantern mythology.
How much collaboration is there between the four of you?
I'd say it's a fair amount. I mean, we're certainly all writing our own scripts, but we talk a lot. The editorial group is great about keeping us all in the loop with one another. They're all here this weekend, so we've had dinners and breakfast together just to kind of hash out some ideas. And you know, I think one of the things that has been made very clear is that we want the Lantern books to feel like they're part of a shared universe, or a shared corner of the universe, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But also, we want each book to have very much its own identity. And okay. I think it's going to work that way. It's going to be cool. And I'm really excited about where it's going to go.
Speaking of which, I see Justin Jordan standing to your left, right?
Yep. There. He's actually speaking with Matt Adelson, who's the editor on the Green Lantern books. So, yeah.
A little bit of a serendipity right there.
Yep.
For Red Lanterns, just sort of really quickly, what is your take on... Because all I know is Rage.
Yes, yep. That's all anybody knows about Red Lanterns.
All right.
My take is to... I mean, first of all, Guy Gardner is going to come and become part of the Red Lanterns,
mm-hmm.
Who I think is pretty appropriate. If you're going to have a Green Lantern who's going to turn red, who's kind of an angry guy...
Wasn't he a Red Lantern previously?
Has been a Red Lantern a few times in the past, but it's always been a very short kind of like, oh my God, Guy's a Red Lantern, we got to solve that problem immediately.
Right.
It's like it's been a disaster. It's in a time of crisis, so he's got to go do it. And in this book, he's going to stay red for, you know, an extended period of time, and kind of we're going to be able to explore the concept in more detail. Which I'm having a good time with. The tone of the book is, I've been saying, it's kind of like a Sons of Anarchy or The Shield or something, where you have you know, bad people trying to do good things by doing bad things.
Right.
So.
Morally ambiguous.
Yeah, all that, which I think is, you know, the Reds work with that.
Yeah.
So.
Just quickly, who's drawing?
Alessandro Vitti is the artist. He is an Italian fellow. He's very tall. Which has nothing to do with anything, but he is very tall.
just to throw that out there.
Yeah, and he's excellent. He's doing excellent work. So that is that's great. The other big project, not only other, but the other big project I have coming up shortly is I'm writing Thunderbolts for Marvel as well, which starts. My first issue is number 12, which comes out the first week of July, so right around the 4th. And that's a blast too. The team right now is. Is Punisher, Elektra, Venom, Deadpool, Red Hulk, and Red Leader. He's the leader, except now he's red. And that's also kind of a bunch of anti-heroes that you can do some really cool stuff with. And it's been really, really fun to work on that. The artist on my first issue was Steve Dillon. Doesn't get much better than that.
Not a bad way to start off.
Unless it's Phil Noto, who's drawing my second issue. So
not a bad way to keep going.
Yeah, and then Hefte Paolo is taking over with issue 14.
Not a bad way to keep going.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about working on these Marvel and DC books is that the art teams are just like, you know, off the charts, off the charts. So, yeah, so there's a lot of great stuff going on right now, and I hope, you know, listeners will check out, you know, any of it. I don't care. Check out any of it. Check out all of it.
That's a lot of red.
There is a lot of red.
Between Thunderbolts and Red Lanterns.
But then I've got the green. Got green going
that's
on.
That's true.
I call myself the Christmas writer.
That's exactly right. It's like very Christmassy, the red and the green. Or very stop and go, whichever way you want it.
Yep.
I just want to wrap this up. You also have, just really quickly, 27 from Image.
Yep.
Now you have two minis of that out.
Yep,
so
there's
far?
Two. There's two. Two trades of 27 that have come out. That is a supernatural rock and roll story, kind of based around the legend of the 27 Club, which is all the musicians who died at age 27. Hendrix, Kurt Cobain. Main character is a rock star, turns 27, gets hit by that same curse, and then he's got to try and beat it. Live to see 28. Sort of makes a deal with the devil to get out of it, and then it just all goes horribly wrong. It's great stuff.
Okay. I think that. pretty much covers it.
I think we've covered a lot of ground, though.
That is a lot of ground. That's a lot of ways for people to check out your work.
I hope they do.
Yeah. So yeah, it's been good talking to you. And let's have another chat soon. We'll get into a little more depth. I know you've got a lot of plates spinning here.
That's the convention. So yeah, and if anybody wants to keep up with my work, you can find me on Twitter at just Charles Soule, CharlesSoule. I'm on Facebook. You know, I've got my website is www.charlessoule.com, and at your local comic shop.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.